Hey, Colette, what's going on?
Racking them and stacking them. How about you?
Well, as always, I am living the dream.
I can see the open collar. I can tell. Well, what will it be?
Oh, what am I feeling like today? Well, hey, anything on special?
Well, there's always the Tiki Love Bowl, but I have to set it on fire before I serve it to you, and that's kind of a nice tie.
Yeah, let's stay away from open flames today. I'll just have the usual.
Sounds good. Hey, hold on one second. Another customer just walked in. Hey, how are you? What will it be today? Who, that guy? That's David. Well, as we know him, D. Fish. He's sort of an all-purpose business talker. Yep, speaking, writing, podcasts, training. He is always talking to somebody about business or music or beer. You never know which way it's going to go, but it's always interesting. In fact, why don't I grab your drink and you go over there and join them?
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of the Beer, Beats, and Business Podcast. I'm glad that you could join me for another round of interesting conversations with interesting people. Today, I'm joined by Lori Rudeman. Lori is a former human resources leader turned influential speaker, writer, and entrepreneur. She owns an HR consultancy and is also the founder of GlitchPath, an early-stage startup focused on project management and decision-making. Here's an idea of how Lori approaches things.
Yeah, my tip is always to de-escalate. Let's just take it down a notch. And whatever's bothering you today, realize that today isn't tomorrow. Things can get better, and what seems important today might seem less important in the future.
I was super excited to have Lori on because she has a very nuanced take on success and failure. And I was excited to see where the conversation would go. My name is David J.P. Fisher, but everyone just calls me D. Fish. I'm a speaker, author, business coach, but really one of my favorite jobs, and the one that's most important today, is to be your host on Beer, Beats, and Business. So enough of this intro. Let's get to it. Lori, how are you today?
Hello, how are you?
Oh, come on. As always, I am living the dream, and it's a good dream today because I'm talking to you.
Well, that's really kind of you. It's nice to be here today, and hello to everybody. I'm sure you have listeners around the world, and it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, awesome. So here's our start-off question. Lori, what are people getting wrong about failure?
Well, just about everything. That's how
they're failing at failing? Okay.
Everybody's a failure. Well, you know, there is this certain trope in today's society where failure is awesome and it's amazing and it's something you have to do. And I take a bit of a contrarian point of view on that. I think failure isn't a badge of honor. It's not something to be celebrated. Failure is failure. And what's so frustrating to me is that most of us fail in the same 10 ways over and over again. So, you know, for me, while failure isn't shameful and it's nothing to be embarrassed about, I'm not walking around welcoming failure into my life. That's not something I want. So I think, you know, if you're a human being and you breathe and you're awake, you should accept that you're going to fail, but you should aim to do better and strive to maybe fail in new and more interesting ways.
Right. So you shouldn't just keep the same, making the same mistake over and over?
Well, you know, I'm not one for celebrating the fact that I'm not empathetic, right? Or I can't balance my checkbook. I'm not proud of it. And that seems to be the message in today's society. You have to experience this. You have to go through this in order to get better. And I'm not sure. I would like people to learn from my mistakes and not make the same mistake that I'm making. So instead of celebrating failure, I just want people to kind of get over it and move on and maybe be better human beings.
Okay.
Crazy. It's crazy. I know.
Well, there's a great saying I heard once, a dumb person doesn't learn from their mistakes. A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person learns from other people's mistakes.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. How many wise people do you know? Not many.
I'm still waiting to meet. I'm sure they're out there, but I haven't experienced them yet.
I'm so dumb. Most of us are so dumb. Isn't that the truth? Oh my goodness. So instead of pretending, right, that we're all wise and we're all meant to learn from other people's experiences on the internet, because that rarely happens. I don't read Tim Ferriss's blog and avoid making mistakes. That doesn't happen to me.
No.
God, poor Tim Ferriss. But I make mistakes and I just give myself permission to say, okay, I made that mistake. How about I don't do that again? You know, like it's just such a novel idea.
So how do you do that? So that's a great point. Obviously it seems so simple, but most people don't do it. So how do you make that happen?
Yeah, there are a couple of techniques that, you know, are proven by science and really just proven by life. And the first technique is to engage in the art of reflection. So before you do anything, maybe think about it first and then do. You know, my local school here, NC State, they've adopted a campus-wide motto, and it's called Think and Do. And it applies for undergraduates, graduates, people who work in the administration. Before you do anything, maybe think about it for a second. And I swear to God, when I say that to audiences, think and do. Think and do, think and do. They start chanting it, you know, because it's so easy to remember and it's so simple. And P.S. go Wolfpack, right? You know?
All right.
Yeah.
I love it. What else? So, all right. So think and, well, it sounds like it's not only think and do, but also then think, do, and then think again.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I'm really big on, and it's something that I've stolen out there from the world of academia, is the idea of a pre-mortem. So you know what a post-mortem is, right? You know what an autopsy is. We've seen it on CSI, NCIS, all of those Law and Order, those great crime shows. Well, a pre-mortem is just the opposite. So you assume that something has died or failed or gone horribly wrong, and you try to architect the ways in which it failed and then do the opposite or do it differently, or maybe just accept that it's going to fail, but try to figure out a different outcome. So it's all about really thinking and reflecting and planning the ways in which things will fail so you can get a better idea of how to direct your project in a positive way. And, you know, I've been trying to do this in my own life for years and I didn't have a word for it. So when someone told me about the pre-mortem, I went, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. Except I called it worst case scenario thinking, right? Okay. And everybody got on me. They're like, oh, you're such a Debbie Downer and you're so negative. But I was really just trying to prevent myself from making those seven same mistakes over and over again. So the actual term for it is called a pre-mortem.
Okay, I like it. Wait, so now you said there's 10 ways we fail and 7 ways we make mistakes.
Yeah, right.
All right.
There are. There's project management science behind it. So I have coined these terms as the universal forces of failure, but project management science just calls it like buckets of risk or categories of risk. And we generally fail at work. And forgive me that I don't remember all 10 off the top of my head, but it's like we fail in our team. We fail in managing our time. We fail in budgets. We fail in either overestimating or underestimating competencies.
Okay.
There's skills. There's a ton. And you know what? People can find them on my blog at glitchpath.com. How about that?
That was great. I will make sure we put the link in the notes. So we're only like 5 minutes in, so I expect you to plug yourself at least 3 or 4 more times.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I only did that because I'm a much better writer than I am a podcaster. So it's like, oh, you want me to remember something? I am so strong when it comes to my writing skills, at least in my own brain. And it's great. Like I'm eloquent and articulate and just on it. And then I stand on the stage and I'm like, oh my God, where are my notes? Now I can plan for that. And again, you know, I should have had those 10 ways in front of me. I should have done a pre-mortem before this podcast.
Oh, hey, don't worry. I'm B3. My goal is to get you completely off your notes and into the weeds, because that's where things get interesting. But so tell me a little bit about Glitchpath, because I know that's like the new thing you're working on. Tell me a little bit about what it is. Pretend I don't know a lot. Which shouldn't be hard because I don't. Like, what are you doing with it? What's the goal? What's happening?
Well, you know, I'm in one of these phases where I am a non-technical person starting a technical company. I am also
always fun.
Yeah, it's just genius. It's the smartest thing I've ever done, let me tell you. So I am also a failed human resources lady. And so I have a lot of experience with my own failure and the failures of other people at work. And so I just am so sick and tired of people making the same mistakes over and over again. So when a friend of mine introduced me to the concept of a pre-mortem, this just cognitive exercise where you try to figure things out in advance, I asked him, do you think this could be software? And he said, you know, I don't know, but if it could, you're the woman to do it. Yeah, I mean, right? That's a huge challenge and a huge compliment. And I have been on this journey to try to figure out, all right, how do I create a collaborative and integrated space where you can take a project and really anything you do in life as a project, from sure. renovating your kitchen to going to Starbucks to, you know, implementing new software. So you take this idea of a project and you try to work in a confidential and really brave way to figure out how things are going to fail. Because I'll tell you what, I have enough experiences with employee engagement surveys to know that face-to-face, people will not say things.
Sure.
But in these mobile, intuitive kind of ways, right, where they've got their phone or their iPad in the bathroom, they will let loose and just be totally honest. So that's what I'm looking for in GlitchPath. I'm looking to create a platform where a team can come together and really point out blind spots and project deficiencies. And then through natural language processing, my software will be able to figure out, okay, what are the biggest risks? What are the biggest red flags? And from there, how do you move these red flags into actionable items? Whether you use Basecamp, Trello, Asana, Workfront, whatever it is, Slack, how do you figure out, okay, this is a really big red flag for the team. We know we're going to fail. We've tried to make a logo before and it's been ugly. We've worked with a client like this before and we've failed. So Joey in accounting needs to do X. How do you move that into action? And that comes from, you know, maybe an honest conversation, maybe some learning, right? Maybe a wiki or some sort of consulting engagement. I haven't quite figured that piece out, but getting it down and in a scheduled way where someone's accountable for it, when it's written down and people are accountable, it gets done. If you can see it, you can beat it. So if you can see that failure on your screen, you're darn right somebody's going to be on it and try to fix it.
Oh, I like that. It's as you're saying this, it's bringing up this idea of creativity.
Yeah.
And the idea that we usually use our creativity to figure out the kind of what you're saying before, we use our creativity to figure out the best case scenarios and not the worst case scenarios.
Right.
And it's almost like what you're doing is saying, how do we use a lot of these creativity tools to also look at what could go wrong and therefore how to fix it?
And you definitely don't need software for this, but what you need is an open mind. And there are two types of people in this world. There are people who believe there are two types of people and people who don't. I believe there are two types.
Wait. We need a pause where I can put the like rim shot in there. Ba-dum-dum.
Please, let's not. There are strategic optimists, people who are out there and cannot even deal with failure, right? They're going to outwork a problem. They're going to put their nose to the grindstone. And when I worked in human resources, these were like recruiters in Paducah, Kentucky, and Indianapolis, Indiana, who were like, we're going to get solid IT technical talent here. And it was like, yeah, good luck with that, right?
But okay, then, yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah, you're going to get somebody awesome to move to Paducah. God love you. Do it. And then there are people like me who are defensive pessimists, and they really see the world as a series of risks. And they're trying to do a risk analysis on everything in the world to try to figure out what's going to go wrong. But they often don't see the thing that's going to go wrong because it's right in front of their face, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, somebody would say, oh, the glass is half empty. Somebody would say the glass is half full. And a defensive pessimist would say that glass is full of poison. You know, like something. Sure. So in order to get people to do a pre-mortem, there's a dial, right? You have to get people not so hung up on failure from an optimist standpoint, like it's not going to kill them. And you've got to get the pessimists in a more like optimistic frame of mind. Like, you can overcome this failure. It's not going to kill you. It's not going to take you under. So this collaborative tool, it doesn't matter what it's written in. It doesn't matter the code. It could be written in Excel. We've got to get people educated to understand that failure isn't going to kill you. That's it. You know, it's not great and it shouldn't be celebrated, but it's not the worst thing in the world, right? You know, you're going to live. You're going to live.
Well, and it sounds like it's you're really talking about like finding a balance, right? Which is kind of always the challenge in many, many aspects of our lives. But as you said, getting that really optimistic person to realize, hey, there could be problems and that's okay.
Yeah.
And having the negative person be like, hey, we can fix this and that's okay too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if you have anybody in your family who has been married or been with the same man or woman over and over again, and that person is negative or toxic or just really awful. And you say to them, like, how many times do you have to go through this before you learn a lesson? I feel like my software, I mean, forget about work, right? Forget about all the problems that we have communicating with, you know, Sally in accounting or, you know, Susie in
cooking. Oh, Sally. Sally, she's a challenge.
I want to take these kinds of behaviors where you do a pre-mortem, get them in the zeitgeist, get them in the population so that the person in your family who's going through the same problem over and over again finally has the tools and the capability to go, you know what? If I go out with that guy on Friday night, that's not going to end well.
Right.
That's my ultimate goal. I'm looking to change the world, man, you know? So it's great that it happens at work. Like, I'm going to start there, but hopefully I teach people better life skills through Glitch Path.
I like it. So at least you don't have any lofty goals.
No. I'm going to keep it real, real mediocre. That's it.
So what has been the biggest thing that that you've learned through this process? I've had the experience of watching a non-technical person start a technical company, and it's an adventure to say the least.
Yeah.
So what has been the biggest thing that you've kind of pulled out of it?
For yourself? It's definitely something that has been the biggest challenge of my life, and I can't understate how difficult it is to move from being this HR lady that I used to be into a regular consultant, which I've been for about 10 years, and moving now to the technical space has been the challenge of my life. And not only that, I'm fully bootstrapped. I haven't taken a penny from anybody, and I'm really bad at math, and I'm really bad at managing money.
Okay. I gather that from the checkbook comment earlier.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's like, oh, wow, this is really something else. I miss the days of having PTO and having, you know, an expense account. All those things were really cool because I don't have that anymore. So yeah, it's definitely been a challenge for me personally. And I'm also really not good at being uncomfortable or delaying gratification. And I think when you're a consultant, you can kind of pop in and pop out. And there's no popping in and popping out of a tech company. That doesn't happen. So for me, I've done a 180 with my behaviors, and it's really good. I mean, I'm really growing, but I'm really uncomfortable. Absolutely. But it's fun. I probably don't sound like I'm having any fun, but I really am.
I completely believe you. I think it's interesting that we often think that comfort and fun are associated, where I think it's quite possible to be very uncomfortable and still have a ton of fun. So I totally get that.
And I think the opposite is true. I know so many people who are really super cush and comfortable and living these middle class or upper middle class lives, right? And something's missing. And then they go on the internet and Google, how do I find happiness? And they think they can find it from a blog, and they think they can find it from all sorts of other stuff. And it's like, maybe don't get that third car. Maybe don't go to Disney with your kids this year. Do something for you. Challenge yourself. Be uncomfortable. You know, there's so much slack in our economy for people paying for stupid things. And if they would only take that money and work at something that's a little bit uncomfortable, but more aligned with their core values, we would move our society forward so quickly. But unfortunately, that's not happening, right? And it's not even happening with me. I just bought two ground floor tickets to go see Green Day in concert at Wrigley Field.
Oh, you're coming to Chicago. We'll hang out.
I I know. I have to, right? I mean, Green Day is like my college band, and I'm taking my little brother, and I took him to see Green Day when he was 7 and I was 19.
Oh my gosh.
We have to do this again. We have to do it again. But I'm like, oh man, how many hours of development could I fund with my company? Oh, wow.
I mean, part of me completely supports you, and part of me is like, Green Day?
I know.
Come on.
I like their new album, actually. I'm surprised, but I like it.
I have not heard it. I really liked Dookie. That was a great album back in 98 or whatever.
I know, but Catfish and the Bottlemen are opening, and I like a few of their songs, so I'm like, all right, this is happening. We're doing this. We're doing it, so we're going.
Well, that'll be fun. Yeah. It'll definitely be an experience. And all right, so you actually segued into something I know that I wanted to talk to you about, because we actually had an exchange recently about this topic. We were talking about, what was the book? The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Bleep. And I'm using bleep because then I don't have to bleep myself out. And I can keep this clean for iTunes.
I love it. All right. I am not keeping it clean for iTunes. I apologize.
Oh, no worries. Why do you think people feel they can kind of shortcut their way to happiness by buying stuff? Or like, I think there's this really insidious thought that's relatively recent where people are going, oh yeah, you know, I know that I can't buy a car to make me more happy, but I can just use this app on my phone and meditate for 10 minutes in a day, and then I'll like be happy.
Oh man, people are stupid. Isn't that
okay? That I like that.
No. I mean, I hear you. And you know, maybe you and I are wrong, because Seth Godin and Tony Robbins are making a mint in this economy. So maybe we're the ones who've got it wrong. And maybe you can hack your way to happiness. But when I think of hacking, I think of a chest cold. You know,
right.
Like in a hawk up a loogie. And so for me, whenever somebody says they want to hack their way to happiness, I think, all right, you're clearing the contagion out of your chest in the short term, but in the long term, there's still an infection there. And this idea that you can hack your way to happiness is really just about avoiding the hard work and the hard truth that is life. You know, life is tough. Life is hard. There are these really great moments that you get if you're lucky. But otherwise, it's kind of a struggle for most people. And if we lie to ourselves and try to go for this false notion that we can be happy or content all of the time, we operate in a state of denial. And I don't think that's healthy for anybody. And, you know, I read that book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Bleep, right? And I was totally on board until Mark started attacking the victims of trauma in that book. And he used a phrase that I don't know if you caught on. He used this phrase called victimhood chic that he sees on the internet all the time. And I mean, I get it. Everybody has a story to tell, but everybody does have a story to tell. The world is so hard, and only people of privilege mock people who are victims in order to show that they're enlightened. And I hated that. I hated it so much.
Interesting.
It was really a struggle to finish the book after that. And there are a lot of good messages in that book about resilience, but you don't try to motivate people to be resilient by diminishing the really bad experiences they've had in life. If anything, you acknowledge it and you give examples of people who have overcome it. Like Malala, right? I mean, there's one big example of a woman who was attacked by a bunch of people in Pakistan, survived, and is now working on behalf of women and children in literacy, and was, you know, recognized by the UN as just a heroine. There are so many people in this world who are doing good work. Victimhood chic is a lie. And so that book really bugged me.
Interesting. I read it, but once I realized 7 pages in that he was basically just going to steal the four noble truths of Buddhism,
yes,
but not mention that at all, I was kind of like, dude, at least give credit where credit's due. Oh,
I know. Well, everybody feels like they've invented like Tibetan Buddhism. It's really interesting to me. You know, I have to say, the more I spend time in leadership podcasts, the more I feel better about myself, because I eat carbs and people hug me. And I feel like if somebody would just hug these dudes, and if they would just eat some sugar and not worry about their abs and their core and their workout and their shoulders and all of the stuff that they're worried about and avoiding death, right? If they would just feel a little bit better, those podcasts would be so much more relatable. But you know, in the absence of all that, I feel real good about where I am in life. So,
well, there you go. I like it. Yeah. And as you said, the literature, let's just call it out there, whether it's books or blogs or podcasts or TED Talks, mm-hmm. right? There's so much good stuff. But as you said, everybody thinks that they just invented it. And what I always am amused by, because I actually study Buddhism and some of the Eastern philosophies, and it's fascinating stuff. It's like they were dealing with the same stuff 2,500 years ago that we're dealing with today.
Yeah. And there's also quite a huge body of literature on failure as well. And it's really about reframing the journey, right? I mean, so many of us are goal-oriented, right? And that's not the way that Buddhism or any major religion really frames the way you're supposed to live in the world. It's not about the goal. It's about the lifestyle. It's about what you give. It's about you as an individual and your core values and how you contribute to the world. And I feel like this literature, especially around failure, that has motivated me so much is that, well, you've got to endure failure in order to get the $25 million check. And nobody right. is giving you a $25 million check ever in this world. You know, there are like 16 people like Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, you know, Oprah, who get that kind of money. And the rest of us just have to make do with who we are in this really weird and wacky economy that we don't control. And so it's important to align ourselves with people who love us and people that we love and people that we respect and do the things that are of value and align with who we are and never mind the rest of it. I really believe that.
I love it. I think we just went off into this like wacky, wild tangents, which as I said, that is the goal of any B3 interview. How can we just go into the weeds?
Oh man, I'm sorry. And I'm sober. I mean, that's the weird thing, right?
No, that's great. Yeah. Well, I mean, your sobriety, that's good or bad, depending on your approach, but I'm glad where our conversation's going. So here's a question I want to ask you. I'm a fan of your blog, right? So good stuff. Do you think one of the things I like about your blog is it's very honest and you're very much like, this is who I am, you know, good, bad, warts and all. What you're saying is very similar to what we'd get if we read one of your blog posts. Mm-hmm. Do you think that people fake honesty a lot online? And so I guess I should give some context to this question. So we were talking about the whole art of not giving a bleep, which is obviously like, I'm going to be really forward and I'm going to swear and that makes me relatable. Or do you know James Altucher?
Uh-huh, I do. I mean, not personally, but yeah.
Sure. His work. Yeah. Like I actually really enjoy a lot of it just because it's so out there sometimes. I'm just like, okay, dude. But then of course it's really balanced with a very sophisticated digital marketing platform and he's still selling stuff. Like, do you think there's a lot of fake honesty out there, or do you think people are really being themselves?
Oh man. I mean, most people are fake. And I would say that while my blog feels like it's honest and I appreciate that, thank you very much. You know, and I do try to show people the inner workings of my life from time to time. I'm only as honest as I feel comfortable being, right? And so I think there's something about my writing skills, maybe my tone that convinces people that it's enough that I'm authentic. But I do think there is this movement out there to be, so it's a couple things. There are people who are swearing positive, sex positive, bodily function positive, right? They put all of these things out there and they make it seem as if, well, if I give you the dirt, that must mean I'm authentic. And what I try to do is not necessarily talk about all of those things that are ugly in my life, but I do from time to time. I also talk about the things that I failed doing, the mistakes that I've made. And I think that's the differentiation. If someone's really telling you how they're a piece of dirt and they're a piece of crud, do you like how I'm being iTunes friendly there?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. If they're really telling you those stories and they're in story format, there's something to be said there. But most of the time, you're not getting stories. You're getting anecdotes. You're getting vignettes. And it's just, it's like an affront to truth telling. It's getting out in front of the truth with a lie. It's an obfuscation. And that drives me crazy. So I'm right with you. I'm absolutely with you.
Well, and it's interesting because I think there's a difference between, as you're saying this, like authenticity and vulnerability.
Yeah.
In that, like, kind of like you just said, you know, you only are as authentic as you're comfortable with. And I think that's okay. We don't have to be vulnerable to be authentic, right?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a good insight.
I hope I'm recording this because that was great. Okay, good. I am. I just checked to make sure we were recording. You know, I think you do yourself a little bit of a disservice where I think you are authentic. I don't think I'm getting the full Lori, or I don't think you're telling me, you know, about the fight you had with your husband or the rash you have or anything like that, right?
I mean, I might, but
you might.
It's for a greater point. It's not for narcissism, because God knows I wouldn't do that if I were a narcissist. What I'm really trying to do is getting at something universal. You know, I've heard Cheryl Strayed talk about being a memoirist, and, you know, I'm not writing my memoir online in a blog, but it's a memoir format. And what you need to do when you write about yourself is make sure you understand what your audience gets out of it. I think that's so incredibly important. So nobody benefits from learning that I have diarrhea. Is
right.
that teen friendly? I think so, right?
Yeah, you're good.
But if I got it because there's like some major movement in human resources departments where everybody's getting the norovirus, I mean, there's a bit of an anecdote there that may be relatable, right? There's something in it for the audience. And so that's one of the questions that I ask, you know, is it worth talking about myself? Is someone going to benefit from it? Am I de-escalating a situation? Am I removing a level of shame? Am I informing someone? And if the answer is yes, I go forward. And if the answer is no, I scrap it and consider it to be like a journal entry. And I just leave it in my content management system untouched, because nobody's learning from it. But obviously, I had to write it. So
right. Oh, I like that. I mean, it kind of makes me think it's, you know, like swearing. Hey, I'm swearing positive. Trust me, when we're not recording for iTunes. But you know, there's a lot of people who write. I know you're one of them, which is great. Who will throw in some colorful language when appropriate. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea of using language, in this case, colorful language, because there's a purpose to it, versus colorful language for colorful language's sake. Like you were saying before, some people just are like, "Hey, if I'm swearing at you, then I must be honest." And you're like, no, that's not how it works.
That's exactly right. You know, I've learned this from great human resources speakers in my industry. So I've been to enough of these conferences. I've seen great people up on stage, and they swear to demonstrate a point, or to wake up the audience, or to really drive home something emotional. And it's not just because they're loose with their language. They're professional communicators. They know what they want to say, and they know exactly what they intend to do. Right?
It's right.
Not a surprise. And for me, that's really inspiring. And I try to do that with my writing. I'm not just dropping an F-bomb in because I think it's edgy. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's edgy. It makes a lot of people sound like 13-year-old girls and boys trying to play grown up.
Right.
But for me, when I say it, I mean it.
Gotcha. I love it. All right. So we can keep talking about this forever, but I want to get onto a couple other topics with you. So I'm gonna ask you a question, and then I gotta do our quick station identification. Skinny puppy. skinny puppy ? So just think about that for a second. And while you do, I'm gonna let everybody know that they are listening to the Beer, Beats, and Business podcast. I am your host, D Fish. If you'd like to reach out, get in touch with me, would love to chat. Easiest way is on Twitter at DFishRockstar. And if you're listening to us on iTunes or your favorite podcast catcher, please subscribe so you can get all of our great episodes. And I hear that all the cool kids are leaving 5-star reviews. So no social pressure whatsoever, but that would really help us out and would make me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. And my guest today is Lori Rudiman. She is a former human resources leader turned influential speaker, writer, and entrepreneur. She has no problems with self-confidence either, which I love, because she says that most people know her as a legendary blogger. And she is a legend in her own time. She also owns an HR consultancy and is the founder, as you've heard, of Glitch Path, an early stage startup focused on project management and decision making. Lori, how can people find out more about you or get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Oh my God, I'm such a narcissist. Holy smokes. All right. So they can find me at L Rudiman, if they can spell it, on Twitter and all the different social properties. They can visit my blog at LoriRudiman.com. But who cares about all that? I'm launching a product. It's now in beta, right? So it's out there. You can just go on at app. www.glitchpath.com and give it a whirl. And again, this is early stage software. This is not Facebook. But I often remind myself that even Facebook sucked at the beginning. And it sucks now, right? So...
Yeah. I love it. I am a huge proponent of making stuff and just putting it out there. I've become in the last few years a huge fan of the word iterative. Do it and then see what you can improve and just keep making changes and letting it evolve. So
I hate feedback just generally in life because most people give you the wrong kind of feedback. But in this case, I love feedback. And I'm curious as to the ways in which my software product can be helpful and productive and make people better at work and at life, better parents, better cat owners, whatever. You know, I just want to know how it's helpful and also how to make it stickier and more interesting. So app.glitchpath.com. Thank you very much.
I love it. Now you can't avoid the question any longer. Skinny puppy. Really? Industrial? That's what you were into? Yeah. Do you still listen to it?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, I'm a 42-year-old middle-aged woman. So when I run, and I'm training for the New York Marathon right now, I have some light industrial on my Spotify mix. My regular mix.
wait, hold on a second. I'm just sorry. Light industrial. Yeah. I love it.
So that's like Two and Ministry and KMFDM. I think, you know, Skinny Puppy and some of the other ones like Lords of Acid, and there were just a ton that Rammstein, you know, that were real hard on my ears. But you have to just give your audience some context. I grew up in Chicago, you know, wearing Doc Martens, loving old school punk rock music and new wave music. I loved Sisters of Mercy and, you know, I even loved Erasure. I had a crush on Morrissey like any other girl. I was trying to be retro because my parents were children of the 50s and grew up in the 70s, and their first date was at a Doors concert. So they
had
the Doors and the Who and Led Zeppelin. And for me, that music was music of my parents. And I didn't want to listen to like Jethro Tull. I thought that was awful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so my dad introduced me to REM and I'm like, because it was him, right? Had anybody else told me about REM, I would have been like, yeah, REM. So I went through this phase of loving industrial music, Revolting Cox, you know, in Chicago, and Wax Trax Records was the scene. So
yeah,
that's my background.
All right. Fair. So did you ever go to the Fireside Bowl?
Oh my God, no. I was a little young both young and old. I've kind of missed the different movements, but I went to Medusa's a lot.
Okay.
So I was of that like oeuvre, you know, that was my time. And I also, you know, just hung out at like this area called Punkin' Donuts, which is now condos. It's like Belmont and Clark. And
oh my gosh, yeah. All right.
Like a bunch of loser kids who came in from the suburbs, you know. And I was lucky enough to grow up for the most part in the city. And so I had a really interesting experience in like 1991 where I went to a Primus, Anthrax, and Public Enemy concert at the Aragon Ballroom.
Oh my goodness.
It was insane. And there was a mini riot afterwards. And my boyfriend and I were like, we got to get the hell out of here, right? But I always had these high school boyfriends who listened to industrial music. And everybody knows when you're like a middle class teenage girl, you just like what your boyfriends like. That's an unfortunate reality in this world. So,
well, yeah, it's a good thing I wasn't your boyfriend. You've been listening to ska and funk music.
I have plenty of that in my life. Plenty of that. I've seen so many ska bands. I saw Fishbone. I was in the mosh pit at a Fishbone concert. So,
oh, awesome.
I had some great musical experiences. Yeah.
You might not know that I actually played in a ska band for almost 10 years. So when I say the Fireside Bowl, we played there a couple times. And for those of you who are listening who don't know the Chicago music scene, for many years, the Fireside Bowl was a bowling alley that had one of the best sound systems in Chicago, weirdly enough, and would have shows 7 nights a week, 5 bands, basically anybody who wanted to could come play. It was awesome.
Is it still even open? Can I ask?
It's so sad. Yeah. It is, but now it's a really nice bowling alley in a relatively gentrified area of Chicago. So,
oh, indeed. That is sad.
It was a passing of an era.
Well, you know, good things can't last forever. Otherwise, they're not good. They just become, you know, kind of normal and rote. So it's special for you. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. So when you're not training for marathons, what are you listening to?
You know, it's funny. I tell this to a lot of people and they think I'm weird. I like music that breaks my heart. So I, in the car, I have satellite radio, and so I'm listening to like Alt Nation and Sirius XMU. So I've got that going on. But I like old school country music. I like Motown. I like anything that makes me sad.
Okay.
Because that's music with emotion and feeling. It can, you know, connect me to my heart. And of course, I've got like top 40 playing all the time in my life. You can't escape Zayn and Taylor Swift. I mean, that's just what's part of the culture, right? But for my money, I want to listen to like Patsy Cline. I want somebody to break my heart and leave me sad. That's, I don't know. Is that weird? It's just like my preferred kind of music.
You know what? Not weird at all. It's just unique in your own way.
Well, in today's music, so if we think about that, that's like Head in the Heart, Lumineers, you know, all these really jangly bands that sing about heartbreak or, you know, having the wrong timing in your life or loving someone who doesn't love you back. I listen to these lyrics and I think, oh man, I wish I could write like that. Oh, it drives me crazy because it's good. You know what it is? It's good writing. Those are good stories. They speak.
Ah, okay.
Thank you for letting me work this out on your podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I can appreciate that. All right. And I had to ask this too. I know you're a big champagne fan. You've already referenced it. That's way too high class for this podcast. Yeah. I also know you're a tequila drinker. Yeah. Any favorites or just whatever's on the shelf?
Well, you know, people try to impress me with tequila all the time. And for as much tequila as I drink in my world, I don't have a palate for it. So I'll tell you a quick story. I like can't tell the difference. I was out at dinner with my husband and the waitress came by and said, you know, we're featuring Justin Timberlake's tequila tonight. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to try this, right? You know, I just have to try JT's tequila. I cannot tell the difference between Justin Timberlake's tequila and Pepe Lopez. It all tastes the same. It all tastes the same to me, but it makes me feel really good. So I'm like, bring me another. This is great.
All right. In tequila's defense, whatever the JT tequila is, probably is Pepe Lopez with just expensive branding.
Yeah. I'm sure it is, but
that's fair.
I mean, I've been all over the world and, you know, people have been like, try this and try that. And I really cannot, I don't have the taste buds for it. And I think part of it is I like the tequila because I like salt.
Okay.
To salt. And so that part of the experience is really important to me. So I won't just drink tequila. I have to have a little bit of salt to it. And I, in my mind, that enhances the flavor. Maybe it just masks it. I have no idea, but it goes down real easy. So yeah, I love it.
All right. Fair enough. I won't push on you.
Do you have a favorite tequila?
You know, I actually do right now. It's called Corzo. Mm-hmm. So as listeners know, my wife is Russian, and so a lot of Russian Americans actually drink tequila, not vodka. Yeah. And her father's just turned me on. I used to hate tequila.
Really?
And the trick is just to have good tequila, and I don't even shoot it. It's just sipping. But the trick is not to drink the Blanco. It's to get the Añejo or Reposado. Yeah. Much better.
Yeah, I've heard this. I wish I had like the sophistication to appreciate this. I don't. I'm just a working class girl from the northwest side of Chicago. I mean, what do I know?
Well, hey, you'll come and next time you're in Chicago, we'll go tequila tasting. Because
I'll drink it all.
Yeah, the advantage to tequila tasting is even if you can't tell the difference, it's still tequila.
Yeah, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you could take on the world.
On the way up. On the way down, not so much.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's something to be said for the next day, just kind of taking it easy. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You gotta kind of put it in your schedule the right way. All right. So on that note, I think before we get ourselves into trouble, it's probably a good place to wrap things up. I always ask all of my guests, the same question as we finish up. If you could give someone a tip to make today a little better, what would it be?
Yeah, my tip is always to de-escalate. Let's just take it down a notch. And whatever's bothering you today, realize that today isn't tomorrow. Things can get better. And what seems important today might seem less important in the future. So let's just all calm down. That's my word. De-escalate. What do you think about that?
I think it's perfect. I love it.
We're going to calm down, and tequila is going to help.
Exactly. Lori, it's been a blast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you. Nice to catch up with you.
As always, thanks for stopping by. You can find show notes and links to the topics in this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. You can also share this episode through social media and leave reviews through iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your favorite podcasting services. This episode, like all others, is brought to you by our regulars over at Patreon. If you'd like to be one of the people with your own spot at the bar, we'd love to have you. Visit patreon.com/B3 and become a regular today. Want to get in on the conversation? Easy. Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar, and we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.
No tequila? Today,
no.
Just water? All right.
A little early. My goodness, yeah.
Okay, there's an old Irish saying, it's always after 5 o'clock somewhere in the world.
No, it's true, but not today.
All right, fair enough. Well, at least one of us can drive afterwards then.
There you go. I love it.